Governor Ducey is among more than 20 governors who want the feds to temporarily stop settling refugees in their states. But critics say that's counterproductive.
The states can offer whatever views they want, but the solution that they are offering in this case is not well-tailored at all to the real problems that exist in the country.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a controversial project in Arcadia is a step closer to historic status, revamping the casino floor for the 21st century. An Arizona teacher treats math and science class like a business, and click, 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 ding!
My customer base went from just being older people or businesses that were still using it. Now I was starting to include younger people that were discovering a typewriter and using it for different reasons.
Plus, old minds getting a new look, and who wants to be on the presidential primary ballot? That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high only reaching 63 degrees. That's about 12 degrees cooler than average. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the low to mid 40s. Sunny skies and a bit warmer tomorrow with a high of 70 degrees. Under sunny skies right now, it's 58 degrees at KJZZ. Governor Doug Ducey is among more than 20 governors calling for an immediate stop to refugee placement in their states. Ducey will take part in a governors-only conference call on Syrian refugees at 3 o'clock this afternoon. In a statement, he says he's invoking the state's right to, quote, receive immediate consultation by federal authorities per the United States Refugee Act, and that the federal government take into account the concerns and recommendations of the state of Arizona as they are required to under federal law in our efforts to keep our homeland safe. Ducey spokesman Daniel Scarpinato says the governor thinks that consultation is important.
He's calling for an immediate halt until this consultation because he believes that that's important, because he believes our priority and his priority as governor needs to be the safety and security of Arizonans first and foremost.
In his statement, the governor also called on Congress and the president to give states more legal oversight and authority in the placement of refugees. Some states have called for an end to the placement of refugees from Syria, but Scarpinato says Governor Ducey's action applies to those from everywhere.
This is aimed at ensuring that there are no refugees in the state of Arizona who have connections to terrorist organizations. And until we have assurance of that, he's calling for an immediate halt of all refugees.
The statements from Ducey and other governors have led to criticism. One of those critics is Ian Millhiser. He's justice editor at Think Progress, a self-described progressive website run by the Center for American Progress. Millhiser's article is called, No, State Governors Can't Refuse to Accept Syrian Refugees.
The law says that governors simply cannot exclude refugees. So immigration policy is something that is largely reserved to the federal government, so the governors don't have any power at all to exclude refugees.
Now, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey has asked for consultation with the federal government about its policy and has asked that the feds not send any more refugees to Arizona until that consultation happens. It seems as though that is lawful, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, he could ask for consultation. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the federal government talking to a state. The other thing is that states do have the power to deny their own resources. So a state can say, okay, federal government, we're not going to help you settle these folks. If you want to do it, you have to either do it yourself or you have to form partnerships with private charities who will help you out. But at the end of the day, you know, the question of who is and is not admitted into this country and allowed to travel freely within it is a question for the national government. This is not an issue where the states have much of a role at all.
Have you seen any evidence yet that any states have said to the federal government, look, you can do what you want, but we're not paying for it?
Right now, what you've seen is you've seen more than two dozen governors put out statements, and the statements range from what reads to me as pure political pandering to, like, actual executive orders. So, like, it varies from state to state what they are actually saying that they are going to do. I suspect it will be the case that the states Some states won't want to help out, although from what I'm told from immigration advocates and from experts in this space, the states don't really play that much of a role in refugee settlement to begin with. You know, to the extent that that's not handled by the federal government, it's often done in partnership with private charities.
Do you think that it would be appropriate for the federal government to sort of take another look at its policy, given that all these states are asking? I mean, almost half the states have asked the federal government to do something about this.
Well, I mean, it's always a good idea for the federal government to think about what it is doing. I don't think that the governors in this case have made a particularly strong case. I mean, the case that they are making is that we should essentially collectively punish all Syrian, and in some cases they're explicitly calling for religious discrimination, saying all Syrian Muslims, because of the actions of several people in Europe who may be Muslim, who are probably Muslim, and are not Syrian. You know, so far, all of the attackers who have been identified are European nationals. So the states can offer whatever views they want, but the solution that they are offering in this case is not well-tailored at all to the real problems that exist in the country.
Ian Millhiser is Justice Editor at Think Progress. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody, along with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry today. In the ongoing investigation into the terrorist attacks in Paris last Friday, police throughout Europe have centered their attention now on Belgium. Thus far, at least two attackers in Paris have direct connections to that country. What is the Belgian connection to this attack and other radicalization rooted in Syria over the past few years?
Joining us is Niels Duquet, researcher at the Flemish Peace Institute. What is the Belgian connection, Niels?
All the recent attacks in France are somehow connected to Belgium, to Brussels. Often it's about the weapons which are being acquired here and being used abroad.
And is there a tradition of radicalism centered in Belgium? Is this a recent occurrence? What about this neighborhood of Molenbeek?
Well, we've had some extremists here for a couple of years now, but there's been a lot of concern lately about young men going to Syria to fight, and there was growing concern that these guys might be coming back to plan some attacks here.
Can you tell me about the notion that Belgium has become an arms trade center in Northern Europe?
Wherever you find heavy criminality, you find illegal guns. These two are very closely connected. So you will find illegal guns in Paris, in Marseille, but also in Brussels. What makes Belgium special, however, are a couple of elements. The first one is the fact that we have a very long history of firearms production and legal possession of these firearms. Until 2006, it was rather easy to acquire weapons legally, which meant that not just people from Belgium, but also people from our neighboring countries came to Belgium to buy weapons here, including criminals. So that way, Belgium sort of got a reputation in the criminal environment that it was a good place to get weapons. And now in 2006, the legislation changed and it became much more difficult to acquire weapons. But this reputation has remained. It's still a place where if you have the right networks into the criminal world, you can get your hands on different types of guns, going from pistols and revolvers, but also automatic rifles such as Kalashnikovs.
The fugitive Salah Abdeslam, who was believed to be the eighth attacker in the Paris attacks, his brother, Mohamed Abdeslam, spoke with reporters in Molenbeek on November 16th. Listen.
I am indeed the brother of those who took part in the attack, but I have not been involved in any way with what happened on Friday the 13th in Paris. I cannot tell you why, I cannot tell you how. We are an open-minded family. We never had any problem with justice.
Is that a believable statement?
Well, it's difficult to say. We know that his brother was one of the suicide terrorists, and the other one is still a fugitive right now. Molenbeek is a place where a lot of young people have certain sympathies for what's going on in Syria and certain terrorist organizations. What we know now is that there are different parts in Belgium where these young people can come from. For example, in the days after the Charlie Hebdo attack, there was a firefight between the police and some terrorists in Verviers, in a very small town in the southern part of Belgium. But these guys apparently were up to a similar kind of attack, trying to attack police officers in Belgium.
Finally, what's the good of these watch lists? And if you make it to Belgium, Is it pretty much impossible to prevent you from getting into France if you have the right documents?
No, there are no borders anymore between the European member states, which are part of Schengen, which means that if you go from Brussels to Paris, there is no border control. Well, they just started them again this weekend, but normally there's no border control. So it's very difficult if everybody keeps their own watch lists and everybody is doing their own business. So what I think we need to learn from this is that we need to cooperate much more in Europe. Police forces, intelligence forces have to cooperate, share information, set up joint operations even more than they do today, because this is not a typical Belgian problem. This is a problem that we have everywhere in Europe. And the fact that there are no boundaries makes it much easier for these people with bad intentions to actually do what they want to do. If you want to plan an attack and you want to do it in Paris, it's a pretty smart choice to do it from Belgium, for example, because it means that French intelligence and French police forces will not be able to survey you as good as they would if you would live in Paris. So criminals and terrorists are using the national boundaries. So I think it's time for us to get over that and to cooperate much more and set up a real European police force.
Nils Duquet is a researcher at the Flemish Peace Institute. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. A house designed by famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright is now one step closer to historic landmark status. The Phoenix Historic Preservation Commission voted for that designation last night. The David and Gladys Wright House was built in the Arcadia neighborhood in the early 1950s, and now neighbors are concerned about the new owner's intentions. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgin was at the meeting last night and joins me now to talk about this debate. So, Alex, what is this debate all about?
It's about noise and traffic. Many neighbors voiced concern about the owner creating a commercial space in an otherwise residential Arcadia neighborhood just south of Camelback. Now, to be clear, the neighbors agree that the house should have this historic status. They just don't believe the surrounding land should be included in that designation. The commissioners ended up voting 7-2 to include all 6 acres in the landmark status. Now, commission member Mark Briggs was very specific about what he intended that designation to actually mean.
I mean historic. I don't mean bowl. I don't mean shade structure. I don't mean any of that. I mean, I want it to look like it looked. I want people to be able to imagine standing there as it looked when that house was built, as Frank Lloyd Wright saw it.
Briggs is referring to the modifications the current owner announced he wanted to make to the property surrounding the house. The acres north of the house used to be filled with citrus groves.
So is it that additional land, not what the house is on, but the additional land around the house that has neighbors concerned about noise and traffic and all that stuff?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Mark. The current owner, Zach Rawling, bought the home right before it was set to be demolished in 2012, and he told commissioners he wanted to create an educational center and public venue using that extra land surrounding the home. And he says he wants to replant some of the citrus trees and restore the original view from the home. And here's Zach.
The current plans call for a series of berms that will recreate a view north over citrus to Camelback Mountain. There currently is a plan for the shade structure and a grass bowl.
But in order to do any major building or modifications or changing, Rawling would need to come back to the city to get a special permit.
Why is this controversial?
To be clear, again, the house isn't the controversial part. Everyone agrees that needs to be preserved. The neighbors are worried that the owner is turning the property into a public venue. And in his plans, he did mention that that was, in fact, the case. Here's nearby resident Gail Andrews.
Multiple public events that bring strangers to our neighborhood on the heels of recent neighborhood alerts occurring near surrounding neighborhood commercial sites are of enormous concern. We are for the preservation of the house. We are also for the preservation of Arcadia.
The city council has the final word on the historic designation and any permits to open the house to the public.
Much more to come on this story. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgin. Alex, thanks.
Thanks.
Still to come, we hear from an Arizona teacher who's been rewarded for her work in the classroom. That and more ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. Happy Tuesday. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The show is bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 63 degrees. We hit 60 yesterday. 75 is average for today. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows in the low to mid 40s. Sunny skies and warmer tomorrow with a high of 70, up to 77 for Thursday. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies and relative humidity of 30%, it's 58 degrees at KJZZ at 218.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony presenting Holiday Pops. This holiday tradition features Yuletide classics performed by the Phoenix Symphony and Chorus, December 4th through 6th. Tickets at phoenixsymphony.org.
The window for getting on the ballot for Arizona's presidential preference election, more commonly called the primary, is now open, which means you should be out collecting signatures, like right now. That's right, you too can appear on the ballot alongside Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, and Ben Carson. Those are the candidates who have already filed. For more on how this works, I'm joined by Howie Fisher of the Capital Media Services Party. Howie, are you out fundraising and collecting signatures right now?
Well, you know, the thought of telling your grandchildren, I ran for president of the United States in 2016. I mean, you can't buy publicity like that.
So what does it take to actually get on the ballot for this?
Well, Arizona at one time had caucus system, similar to what they do up in Iowa. And then we went to a preference primary. And over the years, we've kind of changed what it takes to get on the ballot. But this year, it says if you get 500 names on signatures, basically yourself and 499 of your closest friends, you get to appear on the ballot for the Republican or Democrat or Green parties. Now, you have to be a member of those parties, but it gives you a chance to be there equally. I mean, what's going to happen is people will go to the polls in March, and they will see a list of presidential candidates. As you point out, Ted Cruz will be on there. You know, Ben Carson will be on there. I'm assuming Donald Trump will eventually get his name filed, and maybe they could vote for Mark Brody or Howie Fisher.
I would not advise either of those actions. How many people tend to do this?
Actually, 4 years ago, we had something like 24 people on the ballot. The test was a little different then. But we had a whole bunch of folks who decided, you know, they'd like to run for president. There was a guy from Tucson named Charles Skelly who said that he has a 12-point plan to solve Social Security and the trade deficit. And sure enough, he got some votes. Now, there were only 57 votes, but 57 people in Arizona decided that they wanted him to be the Republican nominee for president. A guy named Kip Dean, who was a hospital administrator in Phoenix. And he said, I don't see anybody on the ballot I like. So, you know, I want to run. And he managed to get, over 100 votes. Now, the chances of winning, you know, you might need a little more than your good looks there, which is why we're both on the radio. But the fact is that sometimes these are protest votes, but sometimes, you know, there's a real opportunity. Now, of course, the other side of the equation is, let's even assume you win the primary in Arizona. Unless you're on the ballot in a few other states, you're not going to be able to go to the convention,
right,
and claim anything. However, under state law, the delegates who are elected are pledged on the first ballot to cast their ballot for the person who's won the Arizona primary.
So my name could be read at the convention.
Exactly. So if Mark Brody manages to get more votes than Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, and given the number of Republicans, Lord knows how the vote will be divided, there'll be somebody standing up on the floor and saying, Mr. President, Arizona casts its delegate votes for Mark Brody. And people go, yay!
My mom would be so proud.
What more could you want? I mean, talk about your own little footnote of national fame.
Do other states do anything like this? Is it this easy to get on the ballot in other states?
It varies from state to state. For example, in some states, you actually buy your way on the ballot. There's a filing fee. And if you've got $2,500, you can get on the ballot perhaps in South Carolina. Some states look for a sort of popularity. You know, what do the polls show? Some states have higher signature requirements. Some states, it's very simple. You self-nominate. And in some states, they look at, well, how many other states are you on the ballot in? I mean, even Arizona has that as an alternative. If you're on the ballot in two other states, we figure, well, you must be qualified, so you don't need the 500 signatures. But you can get on the ballot in Arizona with 500 signatures. And, you know, my guess is you could stand outside the library downtown with a board and say, would you sign this to get me on the ballot in Arizona? And you could probably find 500 Republicans, Democrats, or Green Party members who were willing to sign it to put you on the ballot.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services, you can sign his nominating petition outside of the Central Library in downtown Phoenix. Get this man on the ballot. Howie, thank you.
You're very welcome. And if I get named president, I will find a position in my cabinet for you.
Very much appreciated. Thank you. Nuclear power has gained more attention as a clean energy source. The raw material needed to make that power is uranium, and the highest-grade uranium deposits in the nation are near the Grand Canyon. The federal government has halted new uranium mining in the region, but old mines can still reopen. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Melissa Siviny reports on why those mines are getting fresh attention.
Critics call them zombie mines. It's just what it sounds like. They shut down, lay dormant for years, and rise back up again. Canyon Mine is one of them. It's located on the Kaibab National Forest, not far from the highway tourists take to visit the South Rim. I'm standing in front of the locked gate. I can't get any closer. The company cited safety reasons. Geologist Matt Germanson comes out to meet me. He points to a metal tower. Two wheels spin at the top.
All that is the mechanism that allows the buckets to carry the material from underground to the surface.
Right now, that material is just waste dirt. The miners have dug a few hundred feet. They've got a lot further to go to hit uranium ore.
We're heading down to, I'm not sure, it's below 1,000, somewhere around 1,200 feet.
Canyon Mine was partly dug in the 1980s, but it shut down in the early 90s when uranium prices dropped. A few months ago, the company that owns the mine started to dig again. Some are concerned about this renewed interest in uranium. Representatives of Native Nations spoke out against uranium mining at a recent press conference. Carletta Taluzzi is a tribal council member for the Havasupai, who live not far from Canyon Mine.
We fear that our water will be contaminated and we can no longer consume the water. And it will lead to deaths and cancer and affect all animal and human life.
3 years ago, the federal government put a 20-year ban on new uranium mines in the Grand Canyon area. Older mines, like Canyon, are exempt. The idea was to give scientists more time to investigate. Donald Bills is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey.
From a scientific perspective, is there an impact that's going to harm environment or harm people? What evidence is there to support that impact? We're still in the process of building a database that would provide that kind of evidence.
Here's what scientists know so far. The USGS found 18 springs in the Grand Canyon with too much uranium to safely drink. That's about 6% of the sites analyzed. It's often not clear if the pollution is natural seepage from rocks or related to mining activity. Mines do have elevated concentrations of uranium, but it tends to not move very far. There are a lot of unanswered questions, and Anne Mariah Tapp of the Grand Canyon Trust says any risk is too high.
We don't know 100% what is going to happen with the groundwater in the Grand Canyon with regard to uranium mining. And because we don't know, we should not threaten that precious resource until we have it figured out.
The Grand Canyon Trust wants activity at Canyon Mine to halt until the U.S. Forest Service completes new environmental reviews. But for now, Canyon and other so-called zombie mines can operate under old permits. Eventually, all of these mines must be reclaimed, like Kanab North, near the north rim of the Grand Canyon.
At this time, all of the contaminated material has been eliminated from the site.
Don Pillmore works for Energy Fuels Resources, the Colorado-based company that owns Kanab North and Canyon Mines.
So what you're looking at is the recontoured mine site that's just about ready for seeding.
Desert shrubs will soon cover the site. Once Canyon Mine is depleted, it'll go through the same cleanup process. Pillmore says his company will then look towards other uranium claims made before the 20-year ban. He expects worldwide demand for nuclear power to rise.
So I think there'll be a point when we see the price of uranium move up to where it needs to be for a lot of our operations to turn back on.
If that happens, Pillmore says the company might mine out all of their old claims before the ban on new mining is over. The mining industry wants to end the ban early, while critics hope to make it permanent. In Flagstaff, I'm Melissa Siviny.
A local educator received the surprise of a lifetime this week.
The winner of the Milken Educator Award is Nikki Derryberry.
That was the scene at Mesa's Red Mountain High School yesterday when biotechnology teacher Nikki Derryberry was told at a school assembly she had won a Milken Educator Award. The honor was given in recognition of her exemplary achievements as the school's science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM coordinator, and it comes with a $25,000 award. The proof is in the results. Derryberry's students all passed the Career and Technical Bioscience State Exam, scoring higher than any other school in the district. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke with her this morning at Red Mountain High School.
So were you totally surprised by this honor that you were given by Milken? What was it like for you to find out and kind of describe the scene in which you found out about this?
I was shocked. We had an assembly yesterday, and my students kept asking, what's the assembly for? And I said, the Red Mountain Way, because that's what we were told. So went down to the assembly and noticed that Diane Douglas was there, and Dr. Cowan, our superintendent, and Marlo, the head of CTE here, and all of our administration, and thought, something interesting's happening, but still had no idea. And then listened to everyone speak, and then was shocked when Milken awarded.
How special is it to get an honor like this?
I think I am privileged to work at Red Mountain in Mesa Public Schools with the exceptional students that I work with. And it is certainly an honor to be recognized as someone that is either impacting the future or has the ability to do so. I think it's exciting to know that there's recognition for that, and certainly I'm excited to talk to my students and figure out what project we can work on with the money that we were awarded.
So. How important is STEM in the state of Arizona, given the kind of state we live in, given the fact that it doesn't have a great reputation for public education?
Okay, so I do know that students are not proficient in math. It's a very small percentage of our students who are seniors that graduate that are proficient in math. And then of those, there's an even smaller percentage that's interested in STEM. So what we're really left with is about 17% of students who are both proficient in math and interested in a STEM field. So I think that, one, for the state of Arizona, it's imperative that we're educating our students so that they're prepared to enter STEM fields so that we can fulfill some of the vacancies that we currently have. And two, nationally, we know we have a deficit. So I think that those numbers just show that if our kids aren't proficient in math and our kids aren't interested in STEM, we're doing something wrong. So what can we do in the educational system to promote an interest in STEM? And then how can we increase their math skills, science skills, engineering, technology, and the soft skills that come with all of that?
Are you teaching the next biotech generation here?
Yeah, I think we are teaching the next generation of biotechnicians. And more importantly, I think we're teaching just the future generation of STEM. So I think some of these kids will go into engineering. I think some of them will go into biomedical sciences. I think some of them will stay in the biotech field. I think some of them will be chemists. So I don't think that, and some of them will go and do something totally different that's not STEM related, but they'll have the skills that they need to question and think about things differently.
Congratulations on the distinction and the class and your success. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Nice talking to you as well.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman with Red Mountain High School STEM teacher Nikki Derryberry, one of two Arizona winners of this year's Milken Educator Awards. Also honored was Brittany Matsushino, an English teacher at the Vail Unified District Cienega High School. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ, and still to come, an old school technology finds a new consumer base. That story and much more still to come on the show. Quick check of Valley traffic, 202 eastbound the Red Mountain Freeway. There's a disabled vehicle at McKellips Road to be aware of. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 63 degrees. 75 is average for today, so clearly we're cooler than normal today. Clear skies on the way for tonight, chilly as well. Lows in the low to mid 40s. Sunny and warmer tomorrow with a high of 70, up to 77 for a high on Thursday. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 61 degrees at KJZZ at 2:33.
KJZZ is supported by Smart Document Solutions. For 27 years, acting as a Xerox authorized sales agent, providing the entire portfolio of Xerox document solutions, including equipment, service, and fleet management. azsmartoffice.com.
Which country is the world's largest exporter of beef? Is it the U.S. or maybe Brazil? Nope. The answer, according to the USDA, is India. The cow has been at the center of a recent political storm. Many states in India have banned cow slaughter and the consumption of beef. People have even been killed for eating the meat. The BBC's Rahul Tandon has more.
Welcome to Oli Pub for the best place for beefsteak in Kolkata.
The manager of Kolkata's most famous beef restaurant is welcoming customers. It's pretty busy here at the moment, but in many parts of India, beef has now been banned. Abdul Majid says that could have a big impact on this country's economy.
Plenty of people will lose jobs, not only in the shops and establishments. I'm talking about the slaughterhouse. There are plenty of people engaged in it, especially the skins from that, the leather which is being exported to many European and American countries. They are going to lose all this. And I'm sure the prices will go up due to this. And it will become very difficult for the lower class people who are having beef for so many years. It will become very difficult.
Customers here are discussing how to have their steaks cooked, rare, medium, or well done. So what do they make about the possibility of their favorite meat being banned?
It's a meat for poor people. A ban on this is a ban on poor people. So I think it should not be banned.
Actually, I don't eat beef, but I don't think banning it is a good thing, because whatever we want to have, it's our point of view. Nobody is there to tell us that you can't do this, you can't do that.
I feel it is a ridiculous thing. I mean, people should have the choice to eat what they want. I think it's basically against our traditions and against our values and against our culture.
I've left Kolkata and I've come to Ghaziabad, just outside Delhi. I'm at a farm that's trying to save cows. There are hundreds of them here, many of them being fed by volunteers. For many Hindus, the cow is a sacred animal. Subodh Kumar runs this farm. He believes it's only a matter of time before the Indian government bans cow slaughter nationally.
Well, the way I look at it, if Modi government has a majority in the upper house, there'll be no difficulty. And that should be in the next 2 years. I would say 80% of the Indians, they are Hindus, and they are very sentimentally attached to banning cow slaughter. Now, it is in the interest of the minorities to see what the majority wants. And if they want to live in peace without raising any tempers and hostilities with their neighbors, it will be worthwhile for them to realize which way the wind blows, you see.
Does the economic gain, in your mind, of banning cow slaughter outweigh the economic benefits of the leather industry, the beef industry?
You see, any cow born will die ultimately. So why not wait for it? Why do you want to kill it immediately? And in that process, you can earn a whole lot of milk. You see, it's like killing a goose which lays golden eggs in one day, you see. It's the same kind of thing.
Mohammed Akhlaq was beaten and stoned to death, his son critically injured. This after a local temple announced that his family was allegedly eating beef. A mob surrounded and ransacked his house over the rumors.
Headlines like that have dominated the news here in India for the past few months. It's led business leaders to warn that a move towards an intolerant country could have severe economic implications. Mudha Pateria is one of this country's leading business analysts.
When you consider that India probably has the largest headcount of cattle in the world, and this is a natural competitive advantage, then the very fact that you can't consume it means that it might have to be exported, or if you just can't cut it, then I think you're really looking at a revenue loss.
And that's where we're going, isn't it? Because state after state is banning cow slaughter. Others are banning the consumption of beef. It's an industry under threat.
No, it's more than an industry under threat, because there's a social perspective, the right to free consumption, right to a liberal consumption climate. Today it's beef, tomorrow it could be something else. So the economic signals are not just alarming, but the social and the ethnic signals are more deeply alarming.
The cows are chewing away in front of me. They are oblivious to it, but they are at the center of a nationwide debate. The tone of it may change following the defeat of the Prime Minister's party in crucial elections in Bihar, but it looks like it's still going to dominate the news for some time yet.
That's the BBC's Rahul Tandon in India. Phoenix officials have started soliciting input from city residents about the search for a new police chief, putting up an online survey. So what do Phoenix residents want to see in their new chief? To find out, we reached out to people in different parts of the city. Today we'll hear from two of them, starting with Craig Stebley, president of the Arcadia Camelback Neighborhood Association.
It's all about the community. And to me, anyway, I think whoever the chief is has to have a pretty deep connection with the community.
So does that mean that in your perfect world, the next police chief would be somebody who is already a member of the Phoenix Police Department?
Yes. In the perfect world.
How optimistic are you that that'll happen?
Well, the one we have now is pretty awesome, in my opinion. Mr. Yawner's done a fabulous job in stabilizing the force. I think that kind of points to the fact that someone from within the ranks, someone who knows the culture, the culture of the police department, is a real benefit.
Are there any particular issues that your neighborhood would want addressed by the new police chief?
No, the police, we're in the Mountain View precinct, and those folks have done a fabulous job with our neighborhood, all neighborhoods. You know, they don't treat us any differently than any neighborhood, so. And I got a feeling no matter who the chief is, that culture, again, within that precinct is still going to take care of our community, you know, our local community, our neighborhood.
Craig Stebley is president of the Arcadia Camelback Neighborhood Association. To another part of the city now, and George Young. He's the chairman of the South Mountain Village Planning Committee. He and his neighbors want the new chief to be a big believer in the Community Action Officer Program.
We feel like, well, I feel like, personally, that it's probably one of the best things that they've ever done. I've been involved with the CAO program in this community since we created it. That program itself, I believe, is the biggest asset that the police department has in this community. And I would love to see the new chief, whoever it happens to be a big supporter of community-based policing, or whatever it's called, to where he or she believes in it and does what they can to keep the program going and to keep the officers out there in the community that they have now.
So you want to see officers on the street interacting with residents, interacting with neighbors, really sort of getting to know their beats?
Right. You know, and one thing that I found out over the years with these community action officers that get assigned to us, the ones that stay around for a while, what's important about that longevity is that they get to know people in the community, and people in the community will call these officers personally and tell them something that they won't tell the regular officer, the regular guy driving down the street in a cop car. You know, they're much more inclined to open up to a CAO than they are to a regular police officer. And to me, that's a big asset for the department, because you're getting information from people that actually live in the community and see what's going on and know what's going on, and they're actually a big help.
Does it matter to you whether or not the next chief is a current member of the Phoenix Police Department or somebody who's brought in from outside?
I would rather see somebody that has already been with the city for a while. And I've always felt that way about supporting that position, that if we hire from within, at least there's a learning curve that doesn't have to be dealt with. And sometimes that learning curve, when you bring somebody in from the outside, that learning curve sometimes takes 6 months to a year. And I understand why, but I mean, it kind of bogs down the process. And when you have a process right now with the City of Phoenix Police Department that is bogged down because of budgets and because of lack of manpower, you know, I think we really need to have somebody that's already been here that understands the programs and the City of Phoenix, and they can hit the road just as soon as they get on the job. They can, you know, they don't have to do a lot of catch-up.
George Young is the chairman of the South Mountain Village Planning Committee. It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, November 17th. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. The city of Paris will still be reeling from the terrorist attacks of November 13th when the International Conference on Climate convenes later this month. This conference will attempt to craft emissions and energy use targets that countries will take concrete steps to implement, steps that, hopefully, people will begin to see in their own lives. That conversation at the local level is already gaining strength and momentum. Groups are partnering together to create networks of individuals and communities who can be responders as the climate and its impacts become less predictable.
General Russell Honoré oversaw the evacuation of New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. It was a real education for this experienced Army officer.
Only about 15% of Americans actually dedicate much time to disaster preparedness. And if the predictions work over the next decade, the way scientists are talking, we're going to face major disasters, and unfortunately, the people that's going to be most affected, the elderly, the disabled, and the poor.
Brad Redrick worries about the disastrous effects of climate change on the south side of Chicago, an area that is predicted to face more intense rain events and floods as the planet warms.
You know, we've been warned that with the way that the rain patterns have changed, that our intake system doesn't get rid of the water, and then based on how the water falls and whatnot, we could be flooded. And it happened in a neighborhood in the north of Chicago. So it's a real scenario there, for a possible scenario for a pretty good sized flood.
What do you have to do on your own to prepare and to think smartly about the kinds of things that could happen?
You know, that's what I'm learning now, is just how to do this. It's been very difficult. I'm surprised it seems like people get bored. It's hard to keep this exciting. And then not being an official, you know, I think they tend to even listen to you less.
It sounds to me, General, like Brad wishes he had a couple of stars on his shoulder to get people to listen to him.
The concept Brad has is one that worked in spite of what the media portrayed on who did what in New Orleans. Most of the people's lives that were saved by neighbors. Because government isn't good enough to immediately respond to a major disaster like a Katrina and a Sandy. And that's what Brad is up against in his community, trying to communicate community awareness. And the ultimate idea is you need to be prepared to be your own first responder. Take care of your neighbor, take care of your elderly relatives.
So, Brad, how do you be your own first responder?
Well, by first having your own plan set up, and then working close with your neighbors.
And when we evacuate, there should be no cars leaving that town with empty seats. The majority of people that died in New Orleans were from that vulnerable population, elderly, disabled, and poor. And you know what, John? We found them alone in their homes.
Have you ever had that experience, Brad, finding somebody home alone?
We had a neighbor that passed during the last big snowstorm in Chicago about 3 years ago. He went out to shovel his snow, and they found him a couple days later frozen in the snow.
You take that personally?
Absolutely. And so that impressed upon us the fact that we've got to build a database of who's around us, what their conditions are. Because of this initiative, I found a couple of my neighbors are bedridden. They're depending on services to come and take care of them. But if a snowstorm comes, the service people can't get to them, then who does it fall on?
And you got a map of who's a shut-in, who's not, who's doing what?
You know, we're working on that, designs on setting up something like that, block by block.
Who's in your network of responders?
Now, currently, our network of responders are basically block club leaders. See, the neighborhood that I live in was once highly organized. So these are people I didn't have to really convince them. They know kind of innately that this is something worthwhile.
What about neighborhood businesses?
We did have a grocery store in the neighborhood whose owner came to one of our meetings, and when we were talking about looters and keeping things under control, she told us if there was an event, that it was a disaster, an emergency, requiring folks to get food that we could break into her store and she would not prosecute. So that was real nice, a nice agreement to have. And then she ended up going out of business.
Oh, my goodness.
Unrelated, because there was a fire and the landlord was not good about fixing the store up and she just couldn't make it. See, part of this difficulty is due to the economy. In Chicago, we've been hit hard with a lot of closures of businesses and whatnot, a lot of foreclosed residences.
It sounds like, General, that Brad's facing a flood of economic malaise there in his neighborhood. Sort of shuts the neighborhood down and makes people even more vulnerable and powerless. Any advice?
Oh, absolutely. He's got a passion for what he's doing. You know why he's doing it. And with our FEMA region up there, I'll reach out to them to reach out to you, because we've got to optimize when we have a citizen like you that's helping drive this culture of preparedness in communities. Because I'm telling you, what's coming with the climate change and the impact of it, every community is going to need to be prepared. We've Absolutely. Got unforeseen issues coming with water problems, with impact of heat on crops. You know, when we have problems with crops, John, it drives up the price of food, create global problems.
Well, Brad and General Russell Honoré, thanks so much.
Well, you're certainly
thanks,
welcome.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Brad. Let me in touch.
All right.
General Russell Honoré oversaw the evacuation of New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina, and Brad Rederick is chairman of the Disaster Preparedness Initiative for 60619, a zip code in Chicago.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo on behalf of Rosie's House, a nonprofit changing young lives by providing music education as a pathway to college success. Charitable tax credit donations at rosieshouse.org.
Gaming in the U.S. continues to be popular, but among a more limited population. Industry leaders, including those in tribal gaming, are getting a little nervous about younger generations who are a lot less interested in walking through dark lobbies on the way to put coins into a slot machine. Roberto Coppola is Director of Global Research and Consumer Insight at YWS Design and Architecture in Las Vegas. He talked about making casinos more attractive for millennials at the recent Arizona Indian Gaming Association Expo. He says the numbers aren't all bad.
We found that, for example, when asked about visitation, likelihood to visit a casino in the coming year, 90% of millennials said yes to that question. They do, in fact, plan on visiting a casino property. That compares with 80% of the general population. The really remarkable finding, though, is when you dig a little deeper and you ask them what they're going to do during their visitation to a casino property, 80% of these folks say they're going to spend little or no money on gambling. So clearly there is a draw, there's a social element that casinos have that is enticing, but the actual casino products themselves, traditional casino games, are just not appealing by and large to this demographic.
Why do you think that is, and what might change that?
We did a lot of consumer insight studies on millennials on this exact topic, and when asked about their perceptions of slot machines, for example, there are some recurring themes. You'd hear words like antisocial, boring, something for my grandma, confusing. And that last comment is actually quite interesting and took many folks in the industry by surprise that a slot machine would be viewed by a younger person as a confusing, non-intuitive experience. But if you think about it, it actually makes perfect sense. The industry, the supplier side of the industry has really grown with this one type of slot player who is now 60 plus. And as they've increased their participation in these games, there's been a demand for a more complicated experience, just as the natural evolution of the product line. The problem is that this wave has continued, almost forgetting about the next generation coming up and what they might want. And what they really want is a simplistic, interactive yet simplistic experience. If you think about getting an iPhone, for example, it doesn't come with instructions. It comes with a few screens, and you slide through and you're in. And the experience must be simple and intuitive, or they will reject it.
Some of these resorts are very high-end as well, but what about maybe being on the casino floor? Is there something about that that seems, well, a little bit old school to folks who are 18 to 35?
Yeah, I think antisocial is really the word. The current gaming experience is really, especially on the slot side, which takes up the majority of the footprint of these places, is very much one-on-one almost as if you were staring at a wall, having a really exclusive interaction with the product that you're consuming. Whereas younger folks, by and large, want to be more social. They want to have wide open spaces that allow for social collisions. My work has been focused of late on the physical environments themselves and how can they evolve.
So is there progress being made on that front?
Beyond destination markets like Las Vegas, in tribal gaming, for example, so there are talks right now about phasing in zones, for example, and how can you start to segment your floor a little bit without transforming the entire floor and alienating the current customer base.
If, in fact, the industry hadn't been keen enough on this and they hadn't been watching the bottom line enough with millennials, could this have been something that really could have damaged the industry? I mean, it seems like the time is ripe now, but if people's eyes had been closed, could that really have hurt the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the larger issues really that doesn't get that much press, not really that sexy of an issue, but the regulatory issues here, to make any changes to casino games to allow for more skill-based experiences, for example, more of a true video game-style gambling game, there is a long path to getting regulatory approval for that. Groups like the American Gaming Association are leading the way, but you wonder if they would have really jumped on this 5 years ago, where we would be today versus being in more of a catch-up mode.
Roberto Coppola, Director of Global Research and Consumer Insight at YWS Design and Architecture in Las Vegas, we've been talking about making casinos more attractive for millennials.
Usually, if you want to compose a message, you use a computer, a smartphone, even a tablet. But a new generation is finding that an older technology is just their type. The show's Annika Klein tells us more.
The sound might ring a bell, but when was the last time you used a typewriter, if ever?
These machines up here from the early 1900s. This Blickensdorfer is 1902. From the 50s, this is like a little Royal Quiet Deluxe.
Bill Wall has owned Mesa Typewriter Exchange for about 40 years. The tiny repair shop is filled with typewriters that could take you from Theodore Roosevelt's presidency to Barack Obama's second term. Surprised he's still in business? So is he.
Every year there was less and less work to be done. And so I thought, this is going to play out at some point in time. And I would have never guessed that I would still be here.
But Wall says in the last decade, business leveled out. Typewriters were making a return. He gives partial credit to the generations at the very end of the alphabet, Y and Z.
My customer base went from just being older people or businesses that were still using it. Now I was starting to include younger people that were discovering a typewriter and using it for different reasons.
People who had never even touched a typewriter before were coming into Wall's shop, like me. I gave a 1920s Underwood Standard a try. Is it even typing?
No.
Oh! Oh. It takes some practice, but Wall says he's seen kids as young as 8 hammer away at the keys. This major expansion of his customer base has changed Wall's outlook on the business. It's more of a hobby now, one he's eager to teach to newbies.
It's not that they're keeping me going because of their $8 ribbon that they're putting on their typewriter, but just more for their youthful spirit they bring to this business, and it makes it a fun business now. I have a blast.
The click and clack of typewriters is also familiar in a high school English classroom across town.
All right, this lever right here is the key tension.
Ryan Adney turned his love for typewriters into classroom curriculum. His English students at Alhambra High can opt to type their journal entries on machines donated to his classroom.
I think it created a careful attention, a more sustained attention to their own writing process when they were writing. What were the words they were putting down? What were the letters they were putting down? And how were those correct or incorrect?
After 5 years, Adney has received hundreds of typewriters. So this school year, he's gifting some to students. Today, Alhambra senior Savannah Marion is learning how to use her baby blue portable machine.
Oh, one last thing. When it says backspace, it only takes you back one space. It doesn't fix anything.
It's definitely different from a computer. But for Savannah, the typewriter keeps her focused on the task at hand and away from distractions like the internet.
So I feel like writing and everything as far as a typewriter kind of brings you back and like takes you into your own little world, and you're lost for a little while and you don't think about everything else like that.
Savannah practices by typing something she knows very well.
It's lyrics from a song by the Plain White Tees.
The song is Hey There, Delilah. It was released in 2005. Her 60s-era typewriter makes the lyrics appear on the page, letter by letter. It's a convergence of two eras in American culture, and it's what might keep the typewriter typing a little longer. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
With me now is Steve Goldstein. Steve has been busily typing away his scripts for tomorrow's Here and Now. And Steve, you're going to be taking a dive tomorrow on Here and Now?
Yeah, Mark, actually, yeah, and I actually have used a real typewriter. Just
as have I, yes.
Okay. Yeah, tomorrow we'll have a continuation of our National Geographic series, which has been an annual thing on Here and Now for many years. Oceanographer Sylvia Earle should be an interesting conversation.
All right, what else?
And the Secretary of the Smithsonian, Dr. David Skorton, he took over the job a few months ago, is going to be in the Valley later this week as part of the O'Connor Institute. We talk about all things Smithsonian.
Very interesting. That and much, much, much more tomorrow morning from 11 until noon. That's KJZZ's Here and Now. This is the show on KJZZ on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.